usually parents use a lot. Yeah, do this, don't do this. They have long list of these do's and don'ts. They always argue about this with their teenagers, which harms, you know, their relationship between parent and their teenagers. So according to riwayat and according to Islamic teachings, there are very, very useful and golden rules. If you learn them and utilize them in your life, then you will not feel that he is contradicting with you, he is disputing with you, and he is arguing with you.
So we have about 2 minutes. Can you list these rules for us?
So, as I said, if you respect him since the child age, the foremost, the very important rule is respect. Respect and respect. So, if, for example, you have a son from age zero, you started respecting him 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, till 11, 12, then this relation of respecting, you respecting him and he's respecting you, this becomes very, very strong. You know, it shows result after 14, 15 years. This is one of the rules, okay? The another rule is you become friend with your son or daughter. If you're a mother or father, you become friend and you behave them very friendly. For example, if your son is, you know, interested in games, you also take some time and play some games with him, the games he plays. You also sit with him, discuss with him. This builds the friendship between you and your son. Likewise, listening also, if you listen carefully, whatever he says, definitely in future, this will give him a chance to listen to you. So like this, we have a lot of other rules. If you apply these rules in your life, then definitely it will work with your teenagers.
Okay, thank you very much for sharing some of those rules with us. So I guess it all boils down to respect one way or another. If you missed the program, don't worry, you can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, click on Call of Islam Radio, and you'll find us right there, Islamic Upbringing. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Telegram as well. Simply search Call of Islam Radio, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next program, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Round the world with reporters.
Activists are galvanizing opposition to the government's planned controversial policing bill, which is now close to becoming law, highlighting a number of issues as more Kill the Bill protests are planned.
It's a massive assault on our democratic right to protest in this country. And let's be clear here, this is specifically aimed at the environmental movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding that we tackle the climate emergency, and the Black Lives Matter movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding justice for black people. And when the government saw these two movements in the summer of last year taking to the streets as they did, they decided that they needed to put in place the most draconian legislation.
Many anticipate a new wave of protest as concerns over the right of assembly grow.
I think this will be the government's poll tax movement moment, and we'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cities right across the country, as we have over the last 3 months, stepping up the campaign against this bill. But it's an absolute disaster for democracy in Britain.
The bill could also have a devastating impact on other marginalised communities in Britain.
This government is conducting a culture war. That's what he's doing. He's trying to undermine and eliminate aspects of black culture, Muslim culture, traveller culture. And when you think that people have had a way of life for thousands of years, and now you're going to introduce legislation, rather than facilitating their way of life as British people within a multicultural democracy, you're actually going to introduce a law that denies them their very way of life.
Criticism of government plans will continue amid fears that the potential damage might be irreversible.
The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill continues to see mass opposition up and down the country, with experts deeply concerned about the potential long-term impact on civil liberties. Richard Sudamp, London.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders have taken the highly controversial decision to advance plans on the vaccination of children against COVID-19. The European Commission says more than 300 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine will have been delivered to EU member states by the end of this week.
If we continue like this, we have confidence that we will be able to safely reopen our societies. So we must now focus on consolidating this progress. One important element that we've been discussing is the vaccination of minors.
EU leaders have chosen to completely ignore a plea from the World Health Organization. The WHO clearly states that vaccinating children and other low-risk groups in the EU happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries. The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organizations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries. EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU. Young adults have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries. The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology, but he recognized his country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled, because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... We cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide commissioned by Macron in 2019 said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Elections ended on Thursday after millions of Syrians cast their ballots on the 26th of May to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the nation's next leader. Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoud Sabah, announced the final result in a press conference.
I am delighted and honored to announce the victory of Bashar Hafez al-Assad as the president of the Syrian Arab Republic. I express in the name of the Syrian People's Assembly our pride and appreciation and congratulations to our great Syrian people who voted for a free and great leader.
More than 13 million Syrians out of 14 million voted in favor of Assad. People filled the streets and main squares of major cities, celebrating what they say is a victory against all states that opposed the elections. Chanting slogans in support of President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians danced, sang, and expressed in all ways possible their feelings for their leader.
Western enemy countries' economic sanctions caused food and basic supply shortages in Syria, which forced Syrians to line up for hours at shop doors. Those countries today are definitely surprised to see those lines of people on the streets now expressing their love to President Assad and Syria. We will continue supporting Assad even if bread, water, food and gas are not available.
We are gathering today in all squares to tell all countries of the world that no country will defeat us, no matter how much plots they hatch. We are with Assad and we are steadfast. We all love President Assad.
Currently, Syrians' main demand is for President Assad to improve the economic situation in the country, which is suffering under harsh economic sanctions imposed unilaterally by the West and the United States.
It's a historic moment in Syria, and Syrians have made that clear on the streets. They are celebrating victory over all states that wanted to forcibly topple the country's president for years, that they are the owners of this land and have the right to determine their country's future. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The president of the UN General Assembly visited Pakistan. Volkan Buzgar met senior Pakistani authorities, including Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. His agenda includes regional and international issues, including Palestine, Kashmir, and the Afghan peace process. At a news conference, the president of the UN General Assembly made it clear no one can remain impartial in the face of Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Volkan said that political will shown by the General Assembly on Palestine must be used to force the UN Security Council for the resolution of this long-standing problem. During the 11-day Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, the United States blocked several attempts by other members in the UN Security Council to pass a resolution against Israel. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi briefed the UN General Assembly President about the current situation in the disputed Kashmir region. Kashmir remains a disputed territory between India and Pakistan since 1947. Both countries fought wars and held dialogue, but have so far failed to break the stalemate. Among other issues that came up for discussion during the visit of the UN General Assembly President include the current situation in Afghanistan. Both sides agreed there is no military solution to the Afghan war and that all sides must seize the current opportunity for a peace deal. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
To some, it's the most anti-Israel country in Europe. To others, the most pro-Palestine.
Ireland, a nation of nearly 5 million and a member of the European Union. Days after a ceasefire ended 11 days of fighting set off by Israeli provocations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, Ireland has become the first EU member state to condemn Israeli settlement activity.
The Dáil has unanimously supported the Sinn Féin motion, which recognizes that Israel has illegally de facto annexed large portions of Palestinian land, which is totally illegal in international law. So this is a momentous decision.
The Parliament made other decisions too. It stopped short of adopting an amendment from small left-wing party People Before Profit that called for the Israeli ambassador to Ireland to be expelled.
Although it's disappointing that we have seen that we haven't got the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador, we still have to focus on moving forward with other matters. But in saying that, there's absolutely no support for the Israeli ambassador being in Ireland within the general public. I mean, that's evident across all social media platforms.
The latest move is one of several in Ireland to support the Palestinian cause. The most recent examples, the 2017 hoisting of the Palestinian flag over Dublin City Council to mark 50 years of Israeli occupation, the funding of multiple developmental and humanitarian projects in Gaza, and the 2018 introduction of the Occupied Territories Bill. Still to become law, the bill hands down hefty fines or jail sentences to anyone found guilty of importing or selling goods originating from the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem al-Quds, or the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Slammed by Israel as an expression of full hostility, the bill and the latest condemnation are considered massive wins for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. What has helped foster Irish solidarity with the Palestinian cause? The country's own experience with British colonialism.
The Irish people's bloody struggle for independence from British rule has inspired an emotional connection with the Palestinian struggle, a connection that continues to inspire them to support the Palestinian cause and call for an end to the conflict through Palestinian self-determination. Zaid Huriza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised speech to commemorate the 21st anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. May 25, 2000 represents, as Said Nasrallah noted, the beginning of an era of victories for the resistance in the region. The most significant stance in this year's speech was a warning to the Israelis to keep their hands off al-Quds and Muslim and Christian holy sites in Palestine.
The resistance in Gaza created a balance where they said any assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds will lead to a military confrontation. The new equation that we need to reach is that if they touch Al-Quds, then there will be a regional war. This means all the resistance movements in the region cannot stand idly by if the holy city and the sanctities are under genuine threat. This is a genuine promise that the people of the resistance in the entire region will not forsake the holy city or the Muslim and Christian holy sites to be destroyed.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon gave a detailed explanation of why the latest confrontation was exceptional and why its results yielded a victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis. Experts believe the many victories for the resistance in Palestine are part of the era of triumph, which began in May of 2000.
All the past wars and victories from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza until the last battle were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25th, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Shabah Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated.
Celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty. They believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, enter into a fifth round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement through the removal of U.S. sanctions and a return to full compliance by Iran.
The experts will continue the discussions in the working groups. In the meantime, the European Union, as coordinator, will continue the talks with all participants of the JCPOA and separately with the United States in view of finding common grounds for an agreement to take shape.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the difficult issues that still need to be resolved have become less, although decisions must be made on the remaining differences.
We have made some progress on them, but we are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues. But I'm confident that we would be able to make progress this time and, if possible, conclude the negotiations, which I have to repeat, I'm not confident that it would be possible to conclude the negotiations, but there is the possibility.
Iran has been demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed under other labels against individuals and entities under the former administration of Donald Trump. Iran has also made it clear it would only come back to full compliance after it has verified the effective removal of sanctions, demands that up until now have not been met. Araghchi says he's seen determination and seriousness by all parties involved to reach a conclusion in the coming days, a prospect that he admits is still not by any means certain. Homolesky, Vienna.
The UK Home Office is under the spotlight once more after Home Secretary Priti Patel oversaw an immigration raid under the guise of observing the implementation of the law, but which nonetheless outraged many.
There are other ways to uphold the rule of law and the practices and policies and rules and regulations of any government without sensationalising the misery of people who are extremely marginalised, excluded, and many of which have, you know, travelled an awful long way to seek safety and international protection of the United Kingdom.
In Scotland, despite hundreds turning out to prevent a similar immigration bust, Priti Patel reiterated that she believed British people supported and voted for such scenes.
The Home Secretary is completely delusional. I don't think there was ever a vote that said, do you agree to people being rounded up like cattle, denied their right to appeal, denied an opportunity for their family members to be informed that they have been rounded up, and to be deported or administratively removed from the United Kingdom.
The Windrush scandal also continues as part of the hostile environment to affect many people.
There are one and two and three generations of people being denied services, people being denied access to university places, people not being able to access medical treatments, denied opportunities to access social housing, and it is an absolute blight on this government.
Many people think that modern Britain is simply a far cry from the welcoming image which is often presented to the world.
The hostile environment created by the UK government continues to have a devastating impact on communities, with legal experts concerned about many cases of unlawful detainment and deportation. Richard Sudam, London.
Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Hayyu, ya Qayyum.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. In today's session, we want to talk about God's justice, which is referred to in Arabic by the word adl. The question specifically that we want to address today is this: what is the meaning of this term? And how do we interpret this term? It's necessary to clarify the meaning of this term before we get to explaining why God is just, and then also addressing some of the objections that have been mentioned regarding this subject. Lexically, the word adl or justice in Arabic has many meanings, such as the intention to do something, balance and equality, or falling something being between two ends and two extremes. However, if we examine these lexical meanings, we see that there's a meaning which is common to all of them, and that they all share, and that is that in all of these we see that adl, or justice, refers to placing something in a place that's suitable to it, putting something in a place or in a situation that's suitable to it. It's in this meaning and in this sense that Imam Ali alayhi salam in the Nahjul Balagha, in Wisdom 437, he says, Al-adlu waz'ul umur mawzi'aha. Justice means to place things in the place that's suitable to them. If we want to explain this further, we can explain this in the following way. And say this, that everything, when we look at, there's many things in this universe, that differ from one another, they're distinct and different from one another. Each one of them has a place that's suitable to it. Now, the suitability of that place is either determined by the intellect and reason, or it could be that reason has no say and cannot understand what place is suitable to this thing or not. Like, for example, reason tells us that it's necessary, if somebody gave you a blessing, to thank the person for it. It's something that reason and the human intellect affirms as being good and proper. And reason tells us that if somebody gives you a blessing and you don't thank the person for it, this is improper. Right? Such a lack of thankfulness in this situation, this is not the proper place to be unthankful or ungrateful or not show your gratitude to somebody. Right? This would be an instance of injustice, or placing something in a place that's not suitable to it. And as a result of this, the reason concludes that because God gave us many blessings, it's necessary to be thankful to Him. It's suitable. Being thankful is suitable. This is the place where we should be thankful. But exactly what should we do to be thankful? How should we express our gratitude to God? How should we be thankful to Him? This is not something that reason understands. It's possible, because reason says this, that if you do something and show your gratitude to a person in such a way that the person doesn't like it, instead of showing your gratitude to him, it's possible that may have a converse effect upon it. So here reason doesn't understand this. It's necessary to take recourse to revelation. Thank you for joining us on The Key. We were examining the meaning of justice. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The re-election of Dr. Bashar al-Assad as president for the fourth consecutive time since 2000 is indeed a vote of the Syrian people for the unity of the country and its independence from both Western hegemony and subordination to the ruthless and unelected Arab regimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading President Assad's re-election boosts Syria's independence. Stay tuned for more. The re-election of Dr. Bashar al-Assad as president for the fourth consecutive time since 2000 is indeed a vote of the Syrian people for the unity of the country and its independence from both Western hegemony and subordination to the ruthless and unelected Arab regimes. The result of the election, if it set off celebrations throughout Syria with jubilant people taking to the streets in an atmosphere of rejoicing in a country which for the past decade has been under the relentless attacks of terrorists of all hue and color, it brought utterances of dismay from most Western capitals, including Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin, whose regimes have miserably failed in their bid to destabilize Syria and plant a client clique in Damascus. It was but natural for the tried and trusted friends of the Syrian people, such as Iran, Russia, China, and Lebanon, to congratulate the ophthalmologist whose foresight in choosing the right partners has seen the country safely through a grave crisis and is now keenly eyeing reconstruction, as is evident by the campaign slogan of Hope Through Work. The fact that 14 million people, or 78% of the electorate, turned out to cast ballots for the candidates of their choice, with the incumbent garnering 95% of the votes, is a proof of the aspirations of the Syrian people and a firm slap on the face of the U.S. and other enemies of President Assad, including the illegal Zionist entity. Not just the sizable Christian minority, which has no trust in the pro-terrorist policies of the U.S. and Europe, the Sunni Muslim majority of Syria, including the army, know very well that their freedom, dignity, and stability of the country are indebted to the strong and independent political leadership of the Assad family, the late Hafez, and the incumbent Dr. Bashar. They have not forgotten how France, during its League of Nations mandate between the two world wars, had separated Lebanon and in 1937 handed over Iskenderun and what is now Hatay province to Turkey. They remember the rise and fall of over a dozen governments in Damascus since 1946, within a period of only 24 years, before the emergence in 1970 of the Alawite statesman, Air Force Chief and Defense Minister Hafez al-Assad, to grant stability to the country, which 3 years earlier in 1967 had lost the Golan Heights to the Israeli regime. In other words, whatever Syria has achieved as a strong frontline state against the usurpation of Palestine and has weathered a decade-long terrorist conspiracy to balkanize the country is because of the now 51-year-long rule of the Assads, father and son, who have always favored the unity of the whole Levant, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, into a solid block in view of the common culture, history, and the Arabic dialect of the region. This is what alarms the West and the U.S. in pursuit of its hegemonic policy to keep the Levant divided and to strengthen the illegal Zionist entity. They had hatched the destabilization plus in 2011, which has now clearly failed. Now, with government forces poised for mop-up operations in Idlib and the other occupied enclaves, the re-election of President Bashar al-Assad for another seven-year term will certainly help the Syrian people in rebuilding the country and ensuring its independence.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms. Welcome to today's episode of Youth Station.
Choo choo ka choo, it's the Youth Station for you. This is Sister Zainab Barakat.
And that's Brother Mudaffar Haidar.
That's me.
He's okay. I mean, you know what? I'm just too old to argue about this anymore.
I'm an acquired taste. An acquired taste.
Oh, you're an acquired taste.
Did you say quiet taste? Yeah. No, I'm an acquired taste.
You really
taste.
Are an acquired taste. Anyway, yeah. We're just going to pick up what we were discussing from the last episode, how we were talking about youth and the risk of being alienated.
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 Aided by aliens?
Yes. The youth and...
Do you know what? I laugh at my good jokes. People laugh at the bad ones.
It's the bad jokes that true
that sh- that
show
just
your
proves
genuine
you
self.
You are laughing at me, not with me.
Youth and the risks of being lonely and not having a society, not having a group or circle of friends with whom they can socialize. Let's talk about how awfully that affects their lives.
Yeah, people get depressed.
Depression is definitely one of it. Depression and the feeling that no one understands them, no one supports them, the feeling that what if I'm in the wrong and the majority of the society that I'm living in is doing the right thing because they seem so much happier and prosperous than I am.
Yeah, and then they just keep sinking and sinking down that lonely hole.
Which is really sad. And then, like, even if they wanted to seek therapy, I feel like even the therapists in those non-Islamic societies don't exactly understand or can relate to the problems our Muslim youth would.
No, but what's interesting is not only are we social creatures, the religion of Islam is a very social religion as well.
It is, unfortunately.
عَسَىٰ أَن تَكْرَهُ شَيْئًا وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ. the sister doesn't like the social elements.
No, I still fail to see how a panic attack is khair for me in any way, sort, or form. But hey, if God says it's good, then it's probably good. It probably burns out calories and helps me lose weight or something. I don't know.
But you notice, like, the Salatul Jama'ah.
Exactly.
Right? You know, Allah's saying the
all
best way to pray is together.
Mm.
You know,
eating alone is makruh.
Eating, ahsan, eating alone.
SubhanAllah. Yeah. Share your meal with someone.
You love eating alone, don't you?
I really do. Eating with someone else stresses
me picture,
out.
No, you take a little picture, you put it on Instagram.
Exactly.
And then you're like, I'm going to devour this now on my own. Watching something on TV. That's what you do.
Oh my God, do you have carrots that are in my home?
Huh?
No.
I'm just guessing. But
that was, that bullseye right there.
But for me, I don't like eating on my own.
What does it do to you?
To eat on my own?
Yeah, what does it do
it
inside
my
your
stomach.
Head? No, what does it do inside your head? What feelings come over you that you don't enjoy eating alone?
Let me try and vision it. Okay, so there's a plate in front of you and you're eating it and nobody's around.
Do you feel miserable?
You feel kind of empty, like I am not feeding my
heart?
Soul or my heart. No, man, that is really beautiful if you think about it, sister.
Really?
Allah wants you to sit with others, to share your food. I mean, that is, if you look at what counselors tell families, for example, they always say, you know, make the dinner time, you know, the time for the family to sit together and talk together. Switch off the TV, move away from that. This is your time to interact.
SubhanAllah.
Which is interesting because it's also makruh to speak with your mouth full.
Huh.
right. But at the same time, it's that feeling of having somebody else with you, you know, feeling the chinking of the glasses and the plates and you know, just looking at each other chewing, which, again, is...
Gross.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to throw something out there.
Bismillah.
You entertain the thought for, you know, argument's sake, and we see how well would it work out.
Okay.
How about if Muslim youth don't necessarily focus... they live supposedly in a community with zilch Muslims.
Zilch Muslims. Absolutely no Muslims. They're
right?
full of
They live
Christians
in Alaska. They
Jews
live in freaking Alaska.
Alaska?
Yeah.
Alaska has a Muslim community.
Dang it.
Yeah.
They live in...
Sweden. No, Sweden has... My uncle is there.
Dude.
Yeah. I don't know a place... That's what I'm saying.
North Korea.
Ah, North Korea.
It's perfect.
Is King...
Kim Jong-un?
He's not...
Muslim?
No, he's not one of us?
Dude, no.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I've been going about this wrong my whole life.
How do you think... what is the plausibility of them vibing with non-Muslims?
Oh, very good.
Moral... non-Muslims that are... That have good values, good morals. They're nice and sound people. They're not necessarily someone who... adheres to getting drunk every weekend. You know, they're really good people. They could be good Catholics. They could be good Jews. It's all right to vibe with them, right?
Of course. The Quran says that, you know, Allah does not forbid you from acting kindly and being good with people who are not trying to kill you, who are not trying to fight you.
Yeah.
Right? If somebody's not trying to fight you actively, they're not trying to attack your religion.
Then the default is to be good with
them.
The default
is to
be good
with them.
And vibe with them. And I think if we do that, we will create that sort of, that dialogue, that necessary dialogue that has been missing in a lot of our societies and cultures.
See, where this becomes complicated, sister, is places like India, where Hindus are interacting with Muslims. And Hindus are not like Christians and Jews.
Yeah.
So that...
It makes life very
really
hard.
Really complicates things. Mm. I mean, I've done a kind of ad hoc case study comparing Indians to Pakistanis, because they're really similar people, right?
Yeah.
Same culture, same language,
same food,
right?
Same
but they
big,
hate each other.
Brown eyes,
which is hilarious. Anyway, but I found that
hilarious.
Pakistanis are a little, like, when it comes to their kind of revolutionary ethos and understanding of Islam, I feel it's much deeper, generally speaking. Why? Because the Muslims in India are still preoccupied with, look, can I eat this from the Hindu's hand?
That's sad.
They're just kind of stuck in those kind of issues. Whereas the Pakistanis, because, you know...
They don't have those things to worry about. They've moved on from that.
So this is just an additional benefit to actually living in an Islamic society.
Exactly, definitely.
But yeah, I mean, as long as you're... If you're living in a non-Islamic society, as long as you're adhering to these basic ahkam, Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a little bit tricky for you, but yeah. I mean,
I know a lot of Catholic and Jewish families, or Christian families in general, that are very, very thoughtful and courteous toward their Muslim associates, whether it's their neighbor or someone in the community, or to make sure to give them something. If they're giving them a food, make sure to make sure that it doesn't have alcohol in it, or.
You didn't come to the online Palestine session. We had Reverend Frank Gagnon.
Yeah, Reverend Frank.
He was very nice.
Very nice.
Very nice.
He really was very nice. I especially loved his profile, WhatsApp profile image.
He has this... he's more revolutionary than so many so-called revolutionaries, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I can see what you mean about this courtesy, this friendship. This
exactly.
I've noticed actually something from the Christians. I hope you don't mind me saying, but... he said, I've met Christians, right, who have reverted to Islam, and they're studying in the Hawza.
Right.
I've noticed when somebody converts from Christianity to Islam, they have this, for want of a better word, niceness about them. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They have something about them, the way they talk, the way they interact. I asked one of them. His name's Anthony. God bless him. He's one of my best friends, right? He's become Muslim, right? And I was like, man, I've noticed this trait in Christians. What is it? What is it about you guys? What did you do? Because he was training to be a reverend. So he's got the Hawza training for Christianity,
exactly.
And then he's coming. I was like, what is it? He says, well, we have this concept of grace. He's Indian. In Christianity.
Masha
grace.
Allah.
You've heard Christians say that kind of stuff, right?
Yes,
grace and stuff.
Beautiful.
The way they carry themselves, that nice. I don't know. The Quran says, what does the Quran say? Surely you will find those.
The Christians, yeah.
Yeah, they'll be the closest in affection towards you.
If you were to. Okay, this is totally irrelevant to the topic of our discussion on Youth Station today, which is about solutions for Muslim youth living in non-Islamic societies, whether reverts or born Muslims. And one of the important salient problems that they face is alienation and feeling lonely.
Alienation.
And alienated.
Alienated.
And loneliness.
They're in alien nation.
What do you think is the equivalent for grace in Islam?
We have a concept of grace in Islam.
Mm. One solution that we thought about was joining online communities, online Muslim societies, whether the society is here back home, wherever your back home is, or whether it's, the society that is there but it's hard for you to reach, or sometimes just go the extra mile to go to one of the centers. Sometimes maybe you can even vibe and show with the non-Muslims, like the Christians and Jews, that are closer to you and more compatible to you in terms of their values and their morals, which will affect their morale. And while Brother Muzaffar is thinking about the equivalent of grace in Islam,
I think I found it.
What?
It's the concept of forgiveness. It's a concept that we often overlook. See,
like ghufran.
Yeah, if you forgive somebody, then Allah is more likely to forgive you on the Day of Judgment, right? Why? It's because when you forgive somebody, it changes your personality. Mm. It changes who you are.
Yep.
And so your heart becomes softer, and it's easier for Allah to put you into paradise, into the Jannah, because of that grace that exists in your heart. I don't know.
Next solution, if you could recommend anything to the Muslim, I would recommend reading books. Just turn into a bookworm, you're going to be fine.
That was your solution, sister.
No,
and
it's not. It won't work out for other people. It's not doable, you think?
Well, are we trying to give them solutions to? Are we giving them coping mechanisms here?
Coping mechanisms, solutions. Don't get yourself killed. Potato, potato.
Ah, okay. Yeah, books. Why not? Go read a book.
I mean, dude, come on.
I'm really lonely. I've got no friends. Go read a book.
That does sound like
me. Just enjoy it.
I mean, like, save the English accent. That literally is me.
That's your inner voice coming. That's your inner voice, isn't it?
It is.
Just go read
a
book.
Dude, my inner voice literally is British.
Mm?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't
cynical.
Know why. Yeah, exactly. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where His Eminence says, he who finds companionship and solace in books has not lost anything.
No way. Why have I never heard this?
Way.
I've never heard that.
You heard it today on your station.
I thought you were going to say something else, which is also relevant to the topic.
Wait.
He said, one who is abandoned by family will find comfort and refuge with strangers.
Exactly. Let not that comfort be in a way that, I don't know. Like, sometimes when you get really, really desperate and out of desperation, you click with the wrong crowd.
Mm.
And then that will kind of begin to manipulate and...
Been there, done that, yeah.
Right?
You gotta
compromise
be
your ideologies and your doctrine, and then, like...
Look, at the end of the day, the place where you are living is going to have an effect on you.
Definitely.
Who you are. It is definitely, definitely, 100%. We have a hadith that says, if you want to know a person's deen, look at their circle of friends.
Yup.
You had a different hadith?
No, I said yup.
Yep.
And my deen my deen is non-existing.
Yeah.
I have no forever alone. Oh, there's another hadith, though. We're going to wrap it up with that hadith as well. You know, we're just going hard on the hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He says, loneliness is better than a bad companion.
No way.
And that's a big deal. Solitude is better than a bad friend. Maybe not loneliness, because loneliness has such a thin line between that and like clinical depression. So let's not go there.
Yeah, loneliness.
But solitude is better than a bad companion. So legit, if you find yourself in a society where you can't click with anyone and no one is vibable, you just embrace being alienated.
You don't need no one.
You don't need no one, sister.
You don't need anyone. You know, two friends are a single soul in separate bodies, according to Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Beautiful.
You got a whole family out here.
Yes. Right? We got your back. Yep.
We're just far away.
Exactly.
So you should just go, chill out, read a book. You don't
need
no
about book. Us. Yeah. And we think about you. And inshallah soon, I'll send you frozen falafel. That's all the time we have for Youth Station. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you. Justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.